right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. Here until 5 o'clock on 720 WGN. And coming up a little bit later on, we'll talk some more Oscar talk. The Oscars are this Sunday. So I'll talk about some of the Oscar mistakes that were made and some of the upsets, some of the big surprises and upsets in Oscar history as well. Then we're going to play another round of a pop-up video. Me and Esmeralda are going to jump into that and much more. Phone number is 312-981-7200. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, as you know, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know we love to talk about language and words and phrases and stuff like that and regionalisms and things like that. So it's always a lot of fun to have a guest on who also loves language. And right now I want to welcome to the show. She is an author, a columnist, a foreign language educator, Susanna Jensen. Jansen, and her latest book is Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. And we have a link on our Facebook page with all of that information, and we're going to talk about her book. And we welcome Susanna to the show. Welcome, Susanna.
Hi. Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much.
Okay. First of all, interesting background. You know, for someone who talks about language and teaches foreign language, you really hated Spanish when you were in school, didn't you?
When I first started it, I did. I had a very tough time taking to it, and people think I just must have come easy to me because I became a Spanish teacher and am fluent, but I did. I got off to a very rocky start.
Why is that? And then what did you do to change that? Because I think that's very interesting and probably helpful to people who have difficulty with it.
Well, you know, in high school, in Catholic high school where I was, there just wasn't a lot of choice. It's not like I was going to be able to quit. Plus, the Spanish teacher was my mom's good friend, a lady from Puerto Rico. And so I was kind of stuck with it, and I just put my nose to the grindstone and kept with it until I started to understand how it was put together, what was going on. But another thing you have to remember that in those days, the methodologies of teaching were not at all conversational. So there was also the factor that it wasn't all that interesting to me. You know, we were doing translation and we were doing conjugation of verbs, but we weren't doing any actual speaking in class.
And so that it wasn't until graduate school that you started to really speak it and enjoy it, correct?
It wasn't until graduate school, exactly, which was terrible because I went through 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, and then I had an invitation to the graduate program, and there I was in graduate school, the only non-native Spanish speaker. I was going to say the only gringa, and I can say that because I'm a gringa.
Yeah, that's right.
The only gringa. And with all of these native speakers from Latin America and Spain and Mexico, and I couldn't speak Spanish. It was just a devastating situation. But it's what made me bilingual because we spent so much time together every day, and they really, my fellow students, pulled me through, as did my professors, and I became bilingual.
That's great. And now, you're a proponent that you think that everybody should at least learn another language because it actually it helps your brain. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that's a very interesting thing, Nick. I mean, there's been so many studies done now that show that bilingual people and even infants at birth who are exposed to two languages in the household show signs of improved focus and concentration, better interpersonal skills, problem solving, and memory. And this can even be measured in infants before they have language ability and before they're even able to, you know, walk or talk. And these benefits continue on through life, assuming that the person keeps up with language skills and becomes bilingual. And, you know, things like what they call the executive functioning are accelerated in people with bilingual skills. You know, things like impulse control and flexible thinking and self-monitoring, organization. But I think one of the most important things to focus on is memory as well as concentration. But memory is improved with the study of and the knowledge of foreign language.
It's never too late, though, right? As you get older, you do want to make sure that you are exercising your brain. Because you do lose memory and things like that as you get older. So to keep yourself sharp, it's never too late to maybe learn another language, correct?
Well, I certainly think it's never too late. But the ironic thing about that is that I often hear people say, you know, I just don't think I can take on a foreign language. I just don't have the memory I used to have. And it's ironic because it's actually the foreign language that will improve their memory as they go through life. And I don't think there's any such thing as too late. I admire people who, you know, later on in life take on a foreign language, whether it's in midlife or, you know, adult, young adult, older adult, more aged adult. It's still a very worthwhile thing. And I think it's always very rewarding. I'm not saying it's easy, but very rewarding in terms of, you know, opening up one's worldview and just opening up different kinds of opportunities and perhaps new people in one's life as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the book, Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. Tell me about how that started and what's in the book.
Well, it started because I when I retired from teaching at the college, I took on writing a column in my local newspaper. And I said, I'm going to write this column about words and language and culture. So every 2 weeks I wrote on a different topic, an altogether different topic. Topics as varied as, oh, of course, I had to write about Shakespeare, but I also wrote about Cockney slang, and I wrote about how difficult English pronunciation is and crazy English spelling. I wrote about words that have no translation into our English language, foreign words, and so on. I mean, it just, the list goes on and on. And so I had so many people telling me, gee, when are you going to put the book out? Because this is really good stuff, and we'd like to have it all in one place. So I took all those articles that I'd written. I had about 60 of them by then, and I rewrote them and, you know, worked on them quite a bit, edited and everything, and I published them into a book called Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. And what it is really is 60, you know, shortish chapters on different topics having to do with words, language, and culture. And one of the things people tell me all the time they really love about it is that the chapters are short.
Right.
It's great. Short attention spans.
Right, right. And it's so varied. There are so many different, you cover so many different things in the book. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are in the book. Like, for instance, the spotting people who are lying by listening to what they say or the words that they use. Give me a little background on that.
Well, it's an interesting topic. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I was writing about it during the time of the presidential campaign, although that's not what prompted me to do that. But it did kind of lend an added aspect to it, let me just say that.
Right.
It's quite a big topic, but so many people have written about body language as that, as an indicator of a possible lie being told. You know, things to look for in body language, like shifting eyes and feet moving on the floor. But I got interested in what words are being used. And when I started researching that, it turned out to be a very interesting subject. One of the most interesting things I found is that a person who is lying generally will not use a contraction. Like, they won't say didn't. They'll say did not. Because it's more emphatic. Like, I did not.
Oh.
I did not eat those cookies.
Okay.
Or whatever. Keep it sort of innocuous there. And so it really is quite a big topic that we probably wouldn't even be able to cover in the time that we have. But it's a lot of it has to do with overemphasis of words and assertions of truth. A person will assert their truth by saying, you listen to what I'm telling you. I'm telling you the truth. You got to hear me. The bottom line, things like that.
Right. Okay. Now, what kind of tips do you have for people who are traveling abroad? Because especially someone who like myself, I can only speak, and I can barely speak English. But when someone goes abroad to a foreign speaking country, what are some of the advices that you give them? Obviously, it's different for each place that you visit.
Well, it is, but there's certain basic things you would always want to do. For example, you'd always want to be able to learn the word for please, the word for thank you, the word for where is, or perhaps an emergency word like I need help or something like that. But just some of the what we would call courtesies or niceties, where we can communicate a little bit of human warmth to another person, even though we're not really able to speak their language. And this is usually in the form of words like please, thank you, hello, my name is, pleased to meet you.
Mm-hmm. So those just your basic niceties are a great way to learn something. Here's a question. Now, you said you wrote about Shakespeare, and one of the things that I'm reading here is it says why Shakespeare is a superstar of the English language and how he learned to do the hokey pokey. you care to explain that one?
Well, that is kind of provocative, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, certainly.
I put that in there because the Washington Post has invitationals to their readers where they invite readers to enter certain contests having to do with usually the manipulation of words. And one very famous one is change one letter in this word and give it a new meaning. And here's an example. Reincarnation, coming back to life as a hillbilly. Okay? So you kind of get the idea of these invitationals, the Washington Post.
Right.
So one time the Washington Post had an invitational in which they invited their readers to give the instructions on how to do something in the style of a famous writer.
Oh, okay.
And one of their readers by the name of Jeff Breckland wrote the Hokey Pokey in the style of Shakespeare. And it is a piece of work, but I had to hire a private investigator to track down this man, Jeff Breckland, because I know his it's on the internet, the Hokey Pokey in the style of Shakespeare, but I wanted his permission to put it in my book.
Yeah. Did you finally, tracked him down?
I'm proud of that because it's a delightful piece of work.
Where was he that you had to track him down? What, is he just a mysterious guy?
No, but he wasn't in the state where he was named by the Washington Post. He was three states away in about five moves.
Wow.
It took some tracking to find him.
Yeah, but it's in the book.
It's in the book, and I'm proud of it.
That's great. Okay. okay, Susanna, hang on, okay?
Okay,
we're going to
take
a quick break. Susanna Jansen is with us. Her book is called Word Struck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. It's basically 60 short reads on words, language, cultures. It's to warm your heart, tickle your funny bone, and excite the brain. And it's doing just that. So we'll take a quick break here, and we'll talk more with Susanna on 720 WGN. Good morning. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. My guest right now is author and foreign language educator Susanna Jansen, and her book is called Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language, and we welcome Susanna back. Susanna, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Nick.
I have to say that my crew that I work with here on the overnight show mocks me because of my love for diagramming sentences. I loved when I was in school. I loved diagramming sentences, and it was one of the things that really, you know, made my brain go. Now, is that still taught, Susanna? Because I grew up in the 70s. I went to high school in the 70s, or I went to grade school in the 70s, and it was a common thing. But I don't know do they still teach diagramming sentences?
I actually don't think it's very widely taught anymore. But I'm delighted to find someone who loved it because I loved it so much in the seventh grade that I kept the book. I still have the book.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
That's awesome.
And it's a very old book, and there's all my work of those diagram sentences. But I understood grammar after that.
Yeah, me too. And it was like a puzzle. And I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was fun. I wasn't the greatest student in the world, Susanna. I was not a big history or math guy. For me, it was writing and it was English. That was the stuff that I loved the most. And diagramming sentences, I remember the first teacher, Mr. Tobin, seventh grade again, was the first guy to show us diagramming sentences. And I was so good at it that he would bring people up. He would bring kids up to the blackboard. And then like halfway through them trying to diagram a sentence, he'd go, sit down, bring up Nick, get up here. And it got to the point where I was like the kid who would go up and correct everybody else's diagramming, and I just thought it was so much fun. I'm always disappointed to hear that they don't teach that anymore in a lot of places.
Well, you know, when you think about it, there's a lot of things that we learn that aren't being taught. real widely any longer. And I'm even wondering about punctuation, because when I was teaching college, and especially towards the end of my career, gee, I was having to teach punctuation, and I was always having to see paragraph writing, but punctuation seems to have really fallen by the wayside. Yeah. And spelling, I don't know that spelling is real heavily emphasized.
And also cursive writing. Either. Nobody teaches cursive writing anymore. How do you feel about the way that language has changed over the years and how technology has affected language? I mean, we now, in our vernacular, we use terms like LOL and things mm-hmm. like that. How do you feel about the transformation of language?
Well, I tend to be kind of a purist, and I can get kind of cranky about some things, I have to admit. But on the other hand, when I take the bigger picture, I realize that the evolution of language always happens through those kinds of transformations of words and additions of new words and adoptions of words from other languages. And we wouldn't even have languages such as Spanish or French or Italian, the Romance languages that came from Latin originally, if the Romans hadn't gone out over what today we know as mostly Europe and taken Latin with them, which then degenerated, you might say, or certainly evolved because of the languages in the different regions, evolved eventually into, after it went through the stage called Vulgar Latin, which wasn't vulgarisms, but it was just the Latin of the common people, mm-hmm. it evolved into Spanish and French and Portuguese and Italian. And It's just the way language evolves. But I do get a little bit worried when the evolution is taking place kind of independent of the written word. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
spoken and it's happening through texting and not through the written word so much any longer. I have to say it worries me a bit.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Every time they release, the yearly words that they add to the dictionary, sometimes I'm just like, no, I don't think we need to.
Yes, I agree with you there, Nick, because lately, in the last 2 years, some of the words of the year, every big dictionary company has their words of the year.
Right.
And some of these words of the year have not even been words. They've been emojis or emojicons, which is the correct word. They've been emojis, the little symbols, the smiling face, the crying eyes. And so we're even getting away from words themselves.
Yeah, that's too bad. I don't know. I do want to mention this, though. I'm going to give you an example and tell everybody about this. It's quoted here in an article about you. It says, one of my favorites ever was written by a middle school student who said that Francis Drake circumcised the globe with a very large-sized clipper. Now, what's the technical term for that?
It's called a malapropism.
Right.
misuse of words, and I love those things, actually, but that's a particularly funny one, isn't it? Circumcise the globe with a very large clipper.
That's very funny. Do you have more examples of that in the book?
Yes, I did a couple of chapters about that in the book, because over the years teaching in the colleges and universities, I would just collect those kinds of things, and it didn't really matter whether it was students saying them, or sometimes it was administrators saying them. There was one administrator I had who always said that certain procedures were very clumbersome. And, it was a mashup of two words that he really thought this word existed, clumbersome.
Right.
Clumsy and cumbersome. And I just thought that was hilarious. And I would just kind of take quiet notes in the back of the room, knowing that at some point in time, I'd use these things.
Yeah, that's great. I love,
naming names, though, of course.
Stand-up comedian Norm Crosby made an entire career out of that.
Uh-huh.
That was just his whole routine. I want to mention this. Do you have any pet peeves? Give me an example. I'm sure you do, as someone who loves language. I am not I don't use the language beautifully, but there is one pet peeve that just makes me crazy, and it's when someone says, I could care less. It makes me nuts, because the phrase is, I couldn't care less. And when I hear people say, I could care less, I'm like, oh, well, then clearly you're not passionate about it. So, well, do you have any of those, an example of that? Does I couldn't care less make you crazy, too?
That one doesn't particularly make me crazy, but things like irregardless,
yep.
that makes me nuts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and this goes back to the malapropism and just the misuse of words. There's so many words that are misused in our language. I actually was speaking with an English teacher at a conference recently, and she said, yeah, that editor took my page and desiccated it.
Oh, no!
Yeah, it was an English teacher that said this, desiccated it. And I just kind of pictured the page all dried up and flying away in little pieces. But I'm not sure what she meant.
Yeah.
I know what she meant, but I'm not sure what word. I think that she just totally misused the word.
Yeah.
And totally mistaken concept of the word. But, yeah, I have a friend who used to say in lieu of instead of when he meant in view of.
Really?
Yes. Just a college graduate, professional man, total misuse of words. And that kind of thing, it really does drive me a little nuts.
Yeah.
But it also changed me greatly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, the book is great. Word Struck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. We have a link on our Facebook page if anybody wants to check it out. Susanna Jansen with two S's. SusannaJansen.com is the website. It's been delightful talking to you, Susanna, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Nick. Delightful talking to you, too.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. There's Susanna Jansen. The book is called Word Struck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. We have a link on our Facebook page. That was fun. We got to take a break. We got the news coming up next right here on 720 WGN.